Morning.
Good morning.
That was a rejuvenating quiz. Gets us all back on track. We were having a little theology discussion, Dean and I, on the sign back there about Rebecca being who Rebecca was to the servant. I gotta get my thoughts in order here. And the sign was actually only one part, because the servant asked God, he was going to ask for the drink. And he fully expected that any girl he had asked would give him a drink, because he was asked. But the sign was that she would offer on her own initiative to water the camels. And that was the sign. Whether or not she was from... I often kind of wondered about that, whether... seen as a servant, went right to the well. He was at the well, and he started looking right then and asking God for a sign for all these girls coming down. Whether it would have mattered to the servant or not, if Rebecca had been related in any case. Because he didn't go to the family first, and it would have been fairly easy for him to go and find the family and then start looking, but he didn't. So I often kind of wonder about that, whether in the servant's mind, whether he was as invested in making sure that the woman that he was asking about was actually going to be related to Isaac at all. Something to think about. Anyway, we're going to be looking at Genesis 25 this morning. It's a rather interesting chapter, I think, primarily because it deals with Jacob and Esau. And these are two brothers, twins, not identical, but twins, that as far as brothers go in the Bible, they probably get a lot more press than any other relationship or brotherly relationship that I can think of. We spend a lot of time in Genesis on the interactions of these two brothers, and there's references made throughout the Bible to the relationship between the two. So what we are about to look at this morning is fairly important when it comes to understanding the Bible, and it's fairly important, I think, in just understanding a brotherly relationship as it was at that time, many thousands of years ago. So it starts off. Let's get our Bibles out. Beginning of chapter 25. Abraham had taken another wife named Keturah. She bore him Zimran, Jokshan, Medan, Midian, Ishbak, and Shua. Six boys that Abraham had after Isaac. Now, there's a variety of beliefs on this. Some sects of Judaism actually believe, and Muslim faith as well, actually believe that Keturah was actually another name for Hagar. That somehow Hagar had come back and entered, was still in Abraham's life somehow, and he'd taken her as a wife. Well, she already kind of was, and she bore him six more children. Others believe that Keturah, and they're going on what the meaning of concubine is. In some versions it reads wife, others it reads concubine, and as to what that means, others have taken the position that Abraham actually took a wife while Sarah was still alive and had six more children while Sarah was still alive. That last one, I don't believe personally. Just looking at the relationship that he had with Sarah, and it seemed like he was basically a one-woman man. She was the one who had forced him, was very insistent that he take Hagar in the first place as a wife to have a child. But it seems that his devotion was very much with Sarah, and just the idea that he would take another wife while she was still alive just seems a little bit off to me. I can understand him, especially just in the sequence of events and the way that the Bible and the narrator of Genesis is laying it out. We already talked about the death of Sarah and his mourning for her and willing to shell out any kind of money to buy something when he had never owned anything before. At this point in his life, at the death of his wife, his beloved wife, he takes the steps to actually buy a piece of land in the land that God had promised him to bury her in. So it would seem very unlikely to me that he actually had a wife on the side that he was having children with. Anyway, I don't want to get too bogged down in that. The important part, though, is verse 5, where Abraham says, or it says, everything he owned, Abraham left to his son Isaac. But while he was still alive, Abraham gave gifts to the sons of his concubines and sent them off to the east, away from his son Isaac. And this really has to do with God's instructions and God's input into his life. Because at one point, Abraham was very interested that God use Ishmael as the promised one, as the son through whom all the promises of the covenant that God had given to Abraham would be placed on Ishmael. Because that was Abraham's work, right? Abraham and Sarah had gotten together and said, we're going to make this work, we don't have a child, so we're going to have one by this other woman. And Abraham was very interested that God would use Ishmael. But what did God say? No. I have the promised son for you. I always have. And he is the one through whom the covenant will be passed through. And that will be Isaac. Because you've laughed, his name will be called Laughter. And Isaac will be the one through whom the covenant promises will be fulfilled. So Abraham finally gets it. He finally gets it. And he sends Ishmael and Hagar away. And that's why I don't think that Keturah is Hagar either. He finally got it, and he sent them away. God made promises to Hagar and Ishmael. He told Ishmael, or he told Hagar, that Ishmael would be a great man in his own right, and that he would give birth to 12 sons. So he had his own plan, but it was very separate from the plan that God had for Abraham and Isaac. So at this point, Abraham, even though he has 6 more sons, he doesn't include them in the inheritance. He gives them probably very lavish gifts and sends them off. And it's important for the original hearers or readers of this account to know who these are, because they would have been very familiar with these names and the families that these men started. And Keturah means, has a connection to the word meaning spices in Hebrew. And these people that are now off east, that they had a lot to do with the spice trade in the southern Arabian Peninsula. So anything to do with spices around that time, especially around the time that people would have first been reading this or hearing this account, would have made the connection and said, oh yeah, okay, that makes sense. Anyway, the important thing to note from this is that they were not included in the covenant promises. They were not included in Abraham's inheritance. That all fell upon Abraham's son, Isaac. Now, Abraham lived a total of 175 years. Then Abraham breathed his last and died at a good old age, an old man who had lived a full life. He joined his ancestors, his sons Isaac and Ishmael, buried him in the cave of Machpelah near Mamre, in the field of Ephron, the son of Zohar, the Hethite. This was the field Abraham had purchased from the sons of Heth. There, Abraham was buried with his wife Sarah. After Abraham's death, God blessed his son Isaac, and Isaac lived near Beer Laharoi. There's a lot that goes on there. So Abraham was 175. What this tells us was that he lived long enough, and we probably don't think about this, but he lived long enough to see his grandsons grow to be 15. When you do the math. So he didn't die. And just the way the Bible sort of sets out, you kind of read Abraham died. So you think, okay, he's dead. And now we're starting to talk about Isaac and Rebekah having children. And still in the back of your mind, you're thinking Abraham's dead, but he's not. It's just that the story's moved on, and we've moved on from Abraham, even though he's still alive. But he was alive to see Isaac and Jacob grow to be at least 15. So that's kind of interesting. And he was buried in the cave of Machpelah. And it's interesting how the narrator makes special note to again point out to everyone who's listening or reading that this was the field and this was the cave that Abraham bought. Remember what we were talking about last time, how this is a pretty important event, because by faith Abraham bought that field, because he didn't own anything in the land, although God had promised him, and had promised him several times, this land that you're walking in, Abraham, everything that you see, this is going to be yours, this is going to belong to your descendants. But at the time he was saying that, at the time he was delivering those promises, Abraham owned nothing, not a square inch. And so it was a pretty important event for Abraham to buy that field and to buy that cave and the whole, everything that went around it. And we talked about how very legal it was. And that whole account showed how it was a verbal legal transaction. In a day without contracts, without written documents, what you said became very, very important. So when you made oaths, that was important. They were binding. And the way you said things and the way things were done and your actions and your words, they were binding. So when you read that account where Abraham's buying the field from Ephron, it plainly states what Ephron was selling Abraham, and then it plainly states what it sort of repeats it, but it's saying that Abraham's then receiving that and taking it into possession, and then he buried Sarah there. All very legal. And it showed that without question, Abraham owned this cave. And by faith, it says throughout Scripture, by faith, Abraham buried his wife. By faith, Isaac and Ishmael, because they owned that, Isaac owned that now, they buried Abraham there. But there's an interesting phrase in there. Abraham breathed his last and died a good old age, an old man who lived a full life, and he joined his ancestors, or other versions say he was gathered to his people. Now, that doesn't mean he was buried. It already says that. It already says that he was buried in the cave. It's a very specific and special phrase. It's used a few times in Scripture to give us the idea that the person who was dying was going somewhere else. That death wasn't the end for them. And that's important to think of at this point. Abraham was gathered to his people in a spiritual sense. And God reaffirms this to Moses when he asked his ancestors. He asked about his ancestors who are suffering in Egypt. And out of the burning bush, God says, I'll tell you who is sending you. I am is sending you. I am the God of Abraham. I am the God of Isaac. I am the God of Jacob. He is still their God. And Jesus makes reference to that as well when he's arguing with the Sadducees. Those people in New Testament times, they didn't believe that there was an afterlife. They didn't believe in the resurrection. But Jesus says, why then does God say, I am the God of Abraham? I am the God of Isaac. He is their God still because they've been gathered to their people. They are still alive in a spiritual sense. And there's some thought in scholarly circles that the idea of resurrection among the Jewish people was a later addition, that they didn't sort of have an idea of resurrection. But I think that's bunk. Because very early on in the Bible, we have this phrase. And that's basically what it means. That the people who are doing this, and the people that were writing this, had this idea that yes, there was an afterlife. There was a place where you went when you died. And it was a good place. He lived a full life. Moving on. So, now it tells us about Isaac and where he was living. At the end of chapter 24, it notes that when Rebekah was coming back with the servant, they were approaching this place, Bir Lahai Roi, which means, well, the one who sees me. Does that remind you of anything? Hagar, the first time she ran away, the second time she was sort of driven away, but the first time when she ran away, she was wandering around in this place where she was worried about what to drink, right? And she talked to God, and she cried out to God, and God showed her this spring, this well, and she said, there's a God who sees me. And this is where Isaac ended up living, in this area. And it was sort of, and it was south of where his father had lived and was living. It seems that Abraham eventually kind of settled around Hebron, or Kiriath Arba. And that's where his wife was buried, right? That's where the cave of Machpelah was. But it seems that Isaac had moved a little farther south, and he'd probably taken over the household, more or less, and had most of the flocks and the herds, and he was taking possession of his inheritance and taking more responsibility for everything. And so there he was in this area where there was a well. But it's interesting then that at this point the narrator says that Isaac lived near the well of the one who sees me, and then immediately afterwards there's an account. It says, this is the account of Abraham's son Ishmael, whom Hagar the Egyptian, Sarah's servant, bore to Abraham. And I think there's an intentional link that the narrator is trying to make there. Here's Isaac living in the very place where Hagar spoke with God, and Hagar realized that there was a God that saw her. And she named her son, God Sees Me, Ishmael. And now we're talking about Ishmael. There's a lot of this going on in this chapter, and there's a lot of wordplay, and the narrator seems very, Moses seems very interested in the wordplay and where things have come from. And this chapter is full of it. And this is one of those things. And Ishmael, according to God's promise, had 12. He had 12 sons. And they grew up to be mighty tribal leaders. And they had their fights, and they had their conflicts. But according to God's prophecy, it eventually petered out, and they never became as great as the Israelite nation did. Because at a certain point in history, you don't really hear about them anymore. And of course, their ancestors are still around, but not in a confederacy. Like, these 12 tribes were like a confederacy, a united group, at more or less, but eventually just kind of all filtered away. And that's the end. That's all we hear about Ishmael after that. And then, when you go down to verse 19, this is where the story of Isaac starts. And it says, this is the account of Isaac, the son of Abraham. Now this word, account, or genealogy, or generations, is this word in Hebrew, toldah. And it occurs roughly 10 times throughout Genesis, and it marks sections. And it's the account or the genealogy of certain people. And you probably remember there's the account of Adam, and there's the account of Noah, and the account of Shem, and the account of Terah, and the account of Abraham, and the account, now we're here at the account of Isaac. But what's kind of interesting as well, is that even though it says this is the account of Isaac, The story that follows is actually more about Jacob as a primary character than Isaac. There's some things told about Isaac, yes, but the story that follows is primarily about Jacob. And that's not actually that unusual, because in the account of Terah, it's actually more of a story about Abraham, right? And that's just the way, this book, Genesis, is sectioned off. And I think that's important to know. So this is more about Jacob. Now, Isaac and Rebecca, they were married. And it says, Abraham became the father of Isaac. When Isaac was 40 years old, he married Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean, from Padan Aram, and sister of Laban, the Aramean. 40 years old. So, a little bit later in life, he got married. We're not sure how old Rebekah was. Depending on how you interpret chapter 24, it says that Rebekah, when she came down to the spring to fetch the water, it says she was very beautiful and that she was a virgin. So usually what that means is that she was just entering into that age where she could be married. So that probably could have been anywhere between 17 and 19. Less likely, but possible, is that she was a bit of an old maid and she still hadn't been married. But it's probably more likely that she was on the youngish side. So here she was, marrying a 40-year-old man, which is not as bad as you think it is. I think men in that time were probably just a lot more hale and hearty than we are at 40, quite frankly. I'm approaching, I'm getting there, and look at me, I'm just breaking down. Isaac would have had me on the ground in no time at 40, I have no doubt. But he was 40, and it's an important number for what follows. So, and it says, Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was childless. Interesting. This is a theme that seems to pervade this family, right? Here, his father, Abraham, was... Terah was 70 before he started having kids. And then his father, his son, Abraham, Isaac's father, how old was he by the time he had kids? 100. And then he had, to be quite honest, he was 86, right? Because he had Ishmael at 86. And then, at 100, he had Isaac. And then, he had six more. Abraham... Okay. So Isaac, at 40, still a young guy, right? Still a young guy. He prays to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was childless. So at 40, they got married. And then, for 20 years, he prayed for children. And that's, you don't really get that immediately from the reading. But it does say later that he was 60 when his children were born. Now, after the first year of marriage, couples at that time would have been expecting something to happen. And so at that point, Isaac would have been kind of starting to worry. And so it's not out of line to say that he probably prayed to God for 20 years for Rebecca to have children. An ongoing, daily request to God for kids. And it was important, not only because kids were a sign of your virility, not only because you depended upon your children for support when you were older, and because not only because it was a status symbol, but because Isaac was the son of Abraham, to whom God had made promises that promises that said, your children will inherit this land. They will be great, they will be mighty, they will bless the earth. And so Isaac's feeling this pressure from these covenant promises to have kids. The one thing he didn't do is look outside the promises of God in the way that his father did. Isaac is the only patriarch that remained monogamous throughout his life. His father, Abraham, had two wives at the same time. His son, Jacob, had four. His son, Esau, also had several. Isaac is the only one that remained monogamous. The only one that really held on, and he stuck it out 20 years. Which brings us to an interesting thought. What is that? If you work on a computer, you probably see this a lot. It means something is going on, but you don't know what. Right? You've clicked on something. Depending on the age of your computer, there might be grumbling and grunting going on in there. But nothing else is happening. All you can see is that. And you're thinking, what is going on? What is taking so long? And that is a lesson we can learn from this particular section of this chapter. What is it about waiting? What is it about God and making us wait? Especially in our culture, this is hard, right? In our culture, because we are an instant culture. We want everything now. We have a drive-through for everything to conceivably be driven through for, right? You don't have to wait for anything. Everything's immediate. And if you do have to wait, then if there's an option, you will move on to it, right? And our children are particularly sensitive to this. You tell them something. Yesterday, we told them in the morning, we're going to the pancake house today. We're going to have pictures taken as a family. And then we may have pancakes. And they said, okay, whatever. No. Time means nothing to children, right? Like, no concept. When are we going? Are we going now? When is it? Is it in 20 minutes? Like, what does 20 minutes mean to you anyway? It doesn't mean anything. The only thing that matters to a child is that it happened now, immediately, right? Because that's what needs to be satisfied. This need, this craving, it has to be satisfied now. If I can't have it now, then this is the worst day ever. We hear that a lot. Because they can't have something. They can't have it now. They can't have it their way. But everybody raise their hand if you've been there and been there recently. We want it now. Thank you for being honest. But there's something about waiting that God, he's got a timing. And quite often, it's never immediate. Sometimes it is. But quite often it's not. And that's hard. And that's one of the toughest things, I think, about trusting and having faith in God is the waiting. When you see that symbol and you think you're sure something's happening, but you don't know what. And that's real trust, and that's real faith, is not knowing and just waiting on God. But Isaac did that. Isaac and Rebecca both did that. And this is what happened. God answered. And he answered twins. And that was great. That was beautiful. That was lovely. But wait. The Lord answered his prayer. His wife, Rebecca, became pregnant, but the children struggled inside her. Look at them struggling. It's an interesting word, struggled. And it's a word that's not often used. And it means to bash against, to crush against each other. It wasn't that they were just abnormally fidgety. You're feeling things, right? Yeah. There are things going on, and that's normal. This was kind of abnormal. Even though Rebecca had never had children before, she realized that something was really, really wrong, because these boys were smashing into each other in her womb. And she goes on, she says, if it's going to be like this, I'm not so sure I want to be pregnant. Other versions translate it as, I'm not sure I want to live. With the idea being, why did I pray so hard for this? 20 years! I waited, and this is what I get. And that's harsh, right? When God finally comes through, and then you think, this isn't what I wanted. But she did the proper thing again. She cried out to God. She said, so she asked the Lord, and the Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb, and two peoples will be separated from within you. One people will be stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger. At that point, before they're even born, God has a plan for these two. And he's telling their mother, this struggle begins right in the womb. And it's going to continue throughout history. And the older will serve the younger. God's promises were being fulfilled, but now he's getting specific and saying, this is how it's going to go. And it's at this point that God places the fulfillment of his covenant promises that is going to be carried through the younger, not the older, not both. Interesting thought. When you think back to the way the promises and the inheritance would flow from Abraham through to Ishmael and Isaac, God makes it very clear that it's not both. It's going to be just the one, Isaac. And now, so you're thinking, okay, so now Isaac's children, for any amount that he has, those promises should flow out through all of them, right? At this point, God is saying no. The covenant promises are going to flow through the younger brother, not the older brother. And this kind of goes against tradition at that time, for sure, because the older brother, the older son, almost always got the inheritance, was always the recipient of any blessings or any covenant promises. So at this point, God is sort of putting his foot down and saying, this is the way it's going to be. Later on, and this doesn't always happen, because now Jacob's sons, all of them, they were sort of part of that, the promise. Some of them were picked out for special things to happen. Judah, for instance, was the line that was picked for the promise of the Messiah. But all the land was promised to all of Jacob's sons, even the ones that weren't born through his legitimate wives, as it were. So it doesn't always work this way, but at this point, God is saying the younger will be the one. It'll be the younger. And when the time came for Rebecca to give birth, there were twins in her womb. No idea who these children are, but they are cute. The first came out reddish all over like a hairy garment, so they named him Esau. And when his brother came out with his hand clutching Esau's heel, they named him Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when they were born. So that's how we get the 20. He was married at 40. He had his children at 60, 20 years. 20 years he waited. And then he had fighting twins. The wordplay is very apparent here. The word for reddish is the word Admoni. And Esau eventually became known as the nation of Edom. It also refers to the area where they ended up settling, west of the Jordan River, where the earth there is quite reddish, very red. So it works in several areas. Not only was he red. Now, some commentators have noted that it probably wasn't his hair that was red. That would have been very, very unusual for his genetic background. But that his skin was more, it was ruddy and red. David is described as being a ruddy and red individual when Samuel first saw him. Remember that in Samuel? When he first gets sight of David the shepherd boy, he's described as being red or ruddy. He had a bright complexion, and that was considered something that was to be desired, especially in a young boy. So he was red, he was vigorous, but he did have hair, probably darker, and they named him Esau, hairy, which means seer, and that was the land that eventually the descendants of Esau ended up living in, was this land called Seir. And they figure probably because at the time it was very, there's a lot of shrubs, there's a lot of trees, as compared to the rest of the land around, which was more barren and sort of desert-like. So there's a lot of wordplay going on there. And then Jacob, the word for heel is Akef. And so they named him Yaakov, or Jacob as we know it in English. And the idea being that behind his name wasn't that it wasn't a bad thing. The idea behind the heel was that quite often the rear guard in an army that was marching in war was the heel of the army. And it was an important position because they were protecting the back of the army. There was the foreguard, which was also important. And then they put more or less the vulnerable in the middle. And then there's the rear guard, or the heel, that was protecting the rear of the army. And that was the idea. That's the idea when they named Jacob. He's holding on to his brother's heel as he's coming, as they're coming out of the womb. Jacob's right there, right? And he's coming out. I'm coming with you, and I'm guarding your flank, as it were. And that's the idea that his parents gave to him, that he would be a protector for his brother. But they're also very, they made an important distinction between the firstborn and the secondborn. Esau, he came out first, even though they are twins. So he was the firstborn, and Jacob was the secondborn. Now it says that when they grew up, Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the open fields, but Jacob was an even-tempered man living in tents. It describes two personality types, this section. Esau was seemed to be a very vigorous, very free-spirited individual. There are personality types in this room, I think, that would probably more side and like Esau better than Jacob. And then, of course, there are those of us that would side with and feel more comfortable talking to Jacob and being with Jacob. They're both interesting people. And this particular section just tells us more about their personality and what they enjoyed rather than anything else. The fact that Jacob loved tents is no detriment to him. His father and his grandfather both lived in tents. They were described as living in tents, but the idea was that they were more responsible for the daily operations of the fields, as it were, and of the flocks. And later on, we see what kind of skill Jacob has with the flocks. He's very skillful as a shepherd. He knows a lot about his goats. He knows a lot about his sheep. And that was very important. That was the economic bedrock of his culture, right? So it was important for someone to know that. And Jacob, in comparison to Esau, would have been the clear head in any discussion. Where Esau was more for the moment and following his tastes and what he wanted to do now, Jacob always seemed to take the long view and thought everything out. And again, I think there would be some of us that would have really enjoyed Esau as an individual and preferred to hang around with him. And then there's some of us that would have preferred Jacob. And it actually percolated down to his parents. Isaac had a taste for game, and he loved what Esau brought back for him. Not that they were in shortage of any meat. I mean, they did own a lot of herds. And so they would have eaten meat probably fairly often, but it would have been domestic, right? It would have been sheep or goats. I'm not sure if they would have had any cows, but it would have been domestic. And of course, anybody that hunts knows that there's a difference between wild game and what you pick up in the grocery store. And Isaac loved that. And I think also that he loved Esau's free spirit, and that he would have loved to have been out with Esau and doing the things that Esau did, and sort of living vicariously through his son, while Rebecca was more attracted to Jacob. And perhaps that was because of the promise that God had given her, the sign when they were in her womb, and knowing that the younger would serve the older. Maybe that always stuck with her. We're not sure. It's interesting. I was listening to BBC one time, and it was about an author that had interviewed older folks, people that were had kids and had been without kids again for a while. Like, their kids had grown up, as it were, and they had grandkids, so grandparents and maybe great grandparents. And he interviewed them, and he was trying to find this common thread. And there's a lot of things that he found, but one of the things he found that was interesting was that almost every one of them said, are you ready for this? Almost every one of them said, you will have a favorite. You will have a favorite child, but don't tell anybody. And that's okay. And I think it probably, your child probably changes through the seasons. Like, if I said, who's your favorite child right now? I think a face probably pops up. Any of you parents, a face pops up in your head. But 10 years down the road, that may change. And that's okay, but just don't tell them. And don't treat them anymore. But I think there are going to be kids that you are going to be more akin to. And now a short word on birthright and inheritance. So, at that time, more often than not, when stuff was being passed down from father to son, it was the firstborn son, not the firstborn daughter, but the firstborn son that would get a double portion of the inheritance, and then the rest would be divvied up amongst the other sons. Daughters were expected to marry and go into another family. However, it has been noted in the laws at that time that it was not unknown that the father could decide that it wasn't the oldest son who got the inheritance. And it could be based on extenuating circumstances. Maybe the son was exceptionally wicked, or he died, which would be a given. But there were situations which the father could decide that the inheritance not go to the oldest. And there are also a few instances where birthrights were sold. And that was not uncommon. I mean, not common, but not unheard of either. And that's important to know for this next section on red lentils. Now Jacob cooked some stew, and when Esau came in from the open fields, he was famished. So Esau said to Jacob, "Feed me some of the red stuff. Yes, this red stuff, because I'm starving." And that is why he's called Edom, or red. Now the word cook in Hebrew is zid. And the word for hunter is tsayid. And the narrator, the writer, is making a connection there that the people, the original hearers, the original readers, would have gotten. What he's trying to imply through the use of his words and his terminology is that Jacob was also hunting for something. Even though Esau was described as the hunter, this use of these two words in close proximity suggests that the narrator is setting up the story to imply that Jacob, by cooking the lentils at that time, was setting a trap by cooking. Now you may look at this story as sort of an ad hoc thing, that Jacob just happened to be cooking some stew, and Esau just happened to be out hunting, and he came back and was hungry. But the usage of these words, and the way the narrator puts it, is meant to imply that Jacob set this up. He knew Esau was out hunting, he knew he was going to be back soon, he knew that he would be hungry. So, he started cooking this stew. I have some cooking at home right now. It is delicious. And it smells. I woke her up. I started cooking it this morning, and I woke her up with the smell. It smells savory. It is really, really nice. Jacob knew this. Esau's coming in. He's hungry. He's dusty. He's dirty. He knows his brother, right? They're twins. He knows his brother. And Esau comes in and does exactly what Jacob expects. Give me some now. Now, the proper brotherly response would be, fine, here, take some, go. But Jacob has set this up. This isn't just a crime of opportunity, as it were. First, some of your birthright. Look, said Esau, I'm about to die. What use is a birthright to me? So he's quite willing, at that point, to give it up. Give me the food. You can have the birthright. Who cares? But Jacob wants to make this binding. So he says, swear an oath to me now. And we've talked about oaths. So Esau swore an oath to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau some bread and lentil stew. Esau ate, drank, got up, went out. And thus Esau despised his birthright. Now it's interesting to note here is even though it tells us that Esau sold his birthright to Jacob, it doesn't go on to say that Jacob took possession of the birthright. And that would have been important if Jacob had indeed claimed the birthright, if that would have actually been a legal kind of thing. Even though at a human level it was, what did God have to say about it? What was God's way? He did say that the older would serve the younger. And Jacob probably knew this. His mother had probably told him. But at this point, Jacob is turning into a bit of a deceitful person. And maybe a person that you wouldn't have liked very well if he was doing this kind of scheming. But the text makes clear that Jacob did not received the birthright. It wasn't legal in God's eyes. our plans are not God's plans. When God comes along, our plans usually get messed up, right? And when you see back when Abraham tried to fulfill God's plans through his own ways by taking Hagar as a wife, what did God say? No. This is not the way I had it planned. We're not going to do it your way. And we're going to see further on as we go into the story of Esau and Jacob, where even though Jacob thought he had the birthright of Esau, it turned out very bad, right? It didn't go at all the way he had thought it would. And he ended up running away. And it wasn't God's plan. God's plan, God's way, and our plans are shattered. And I think that's the important part of this story, is that we remember that even though we can scheme and we can try very hard to manipulate the circumstances of life so they go the way that we think they should, God laughs. Now, there's a psalm that says, the nations plot in vain. And God just laughs at the schemes of man. And that includes even people that belong to him. God makes promises, but we're not the ones that fulfill them. God's the one that fulfills them. And he does it in his own timing, and he does it in his own way. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for this time together in your word. We thank you for the story of Esau and Jacob. I just pray that you would give us all the patience to wait on you, to follow your plan and wait on whatever it is. And that's hard. We know that that's hard. And you know that it's hard. So give us more grace, please. Give us the strength to wait and the strength to wait for your plan, because it's always better. It's always better than ours. In Jesus' name, amen.